Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Every month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Michael Bryant. Mike has the rare distinction of having earned a PhD in history and having graduated from law school and practiced in the law. While he's interested in many aspects of modern German history, his writing focuses on the question of how societies, Germany in particular, have wrestled with what to do with perpetrators of mass violence. His first book focused on the German trials of participants in the euthanasia program. His second, which is the subject of today's interview, looks at the trials of the guards and administrators of the Operation Reinhard camps. Published by the University of Tennessee Press, Eyewitness to Genocide often reads more like true crime than like history, and I mean that as a sincere compliment. At its heart, it addresses a basic question. What does justice mean for people who participated in mass murder, and how did these trials try to achieve this? These are questions with specific relevance to Germany, but are also ones that apply more broadly across many societies that struggle with a violent past. It's a fascinating book, and I'm looking forward to talking to Mike about them. Before we do that, in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I've known Mike for a long time. He and I were both graduate students at Ohio State under Alan Byerson, and we've stayed friends ever since. So with that, Mike, thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So a lawyer and a PhD, the natural place to start with maybe is, how did you end up having both of those degrees?
It is an exotic combination, no doubt. For me, it actually goes back to the 1980s when I decided that I wanted to go to law school and pursue a pretty conventional path that would lead me into some sort of a corporate practice and on into the middle class. At the same time, however, like a lot of young people that were in search of themselves, I decided I wanted to get a theology degree. I flirted for a time with maybe becoming a pastor. My grandfather was a minister, and I was very interested in religion and very interested in theology at the time. So I looked up programs that would enable me to study both law and theology, and lo and behold, Emory University in Atlanta was one of the few schools that afforded this opportunity. So I began my legal studies in 1985, the fall of 1985, and also studied theology at the same time. And during the course of my theological studies, I developed an interest in German theology in particular, you know, the work of Karl Barth and Rudolf Bultmann and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and some others. And decided to apply for a fellowship that would take me over to Germany to study German theology for a year at the University of Göttingen. I applied for it and was accepted. And so I took a break from my legal studies for about a year and spent time in Germany. And it was during that time in Germany that I encountered the work of Ernst Klee, who was one of the really great figures in the historiography of the Holocaust. I picked up a book by Klee primarily because his writing was so clear, and I was still kind of learning my German, trying to solidify my understanding of the language, and Klee's prose was so clear, I thought that he'd be a good person to study. So I picked up one of his books. It turned out it was his classic work, Euthanasia in the NS, the National Socialist State, and read the book from cover to cover. It was the first German book I had ever read, and it was a long slog, but again, I was able to understand a lot of what I was reading at the time. And this was just a kind of a coincidental entree into Holocaust studies. I think I might have read just two or three books on the topic of World War II and the Holocaust prior to that time. But it was Klee's work that really opened my eyes to the phenomenon of Nazi criminality in a way that I had never fully understood until that time. So that would have been in the late 1980s. And by the time I finished at the University of Göttingen, I returned to the United States, finished my law degree, and took the bar exam, passed it. But I wanted to go back to Germany. I had the bug. Mm-hmm. And so what do? You're a young person. You want to go back to Germany, or back to Europe at least, but you want to ply your trade as an attorney. And I found that the best way, and for me, about the only way I could do it, was by joining the Air Force. I remember talking to the recruiter, and they guaranteed they would send me to Germany. And looked at the contract that they presented, and sure enough, there it was, the draft that guaranteed I would be sent to Germany. I signed the bottom line, the dotted line, and I became a JAG officer. And was sent to Germany. They were good to their word and to their contract. And for the next 3 years, I lived in Germany, working as a JAG officer, doing primarily criminal work. And there's the aspect of the criminal law that has been, you know, so important to my work as an academic. But as I was in Germany, I continued to read widely. I continued to read more about the Holocaust and about Nazi crimes, of course, the Nuremberg War Crimes trials. And I really developed a real interest in the topic to the point where I was giving serious consideration to eventually giving up the practice of law entirely and going back to school and getting a PhD. Initially, I didn't even want to do that. I wanted to go directly into some kind of teaching, but I found that the prospects were very limited. And it became clear to me over time that I really had to have a doctorate in order to do the sort of teaching and research that I wanted to do. And my wife at the time, we were seeing each other. She was a graduate student in social work in the MSW program at Ohio State. And I wanted to go back and be with her once I got out of the military. Mm-hmm. And so I went back. I tried to find the guy who was in charge of the German history program at Ohio State, and it was Alan Bayerschen, whom you know quite well. Mm-hmm. And I met with Alan several times, and we hit it off. I think our first lunch engagement lasted 3 hours. Does that sound familiar at all to you?
So it was short by Bayerschen standards.
Yes, it was. And that really cemented the relationship. So I decided, once I left the military, take my GI Bill and went back to school and then got a PhD at Ohio State teaching in modern German history. Teaching like all of us did, world civilization, Western civ, things of that nature as a graduate student. And then eventually once I got the doctorate, I moved into full-time university teaching, and I haven't looked back.
So why this book?
This book, at least from my perspective, is an extension of my dissertation. And you said at the beginning of the podcast that my first book looked at euthanasia crimes. That's not a coincidence, based on my exposure to the whole topic, the sprawling topic of Nazi criminality through Ernst Klee and his work, Euthanasia and the National Socialist State. I had developed an interest in the euthanasia topic. And I think that my interest was more than just historical. I had an ethical interest in it as well, that was driven maybe by interest in social justice and the way in which society treats its some of its most unfortunate members. So this topic was really interesting to me, and so I decided to look at the trial of Nazi war criminals who were involved specifically in crimes against the mentally disabled. And that turned into my dissertation and then eventually into my first book. I think many of us try to write our dissertation as far as we can take it into an initial book, and then we segue into other topics thereafter. So for me, euthanasia formed the crux of the first book. But I wanted to come back and revisit the issue of Nazi criminality and the trials of Nazi war criminals by German courts. But in the second book, within the context of the Final Solution. So I thought that as a good complement to the euthanasia crimes, and the focus on euthanasia crimes would be a second book looking in greater detail in Germany's, West Germany's confrontation with Nazi criminality in the 50s and 60s, and the way in which the Germans were able to construct a fairly robust investigation and prosecution apparatus in the late 1950s into the 1960s that continues into the present day. And as you know, these trials are still going on. Mm-hmm. Demjanjuk, of course, John Demjanjuk, the Cleveland auto worker, was convicted in, I think, 2011. And his conviction, of course, spurred a new interest in investigating and indicting and prosecuting at this point, very elderly Nazi war criminals who were involved in service in the death camps and elsewhere during the Third Reich. So this program really, in its current form, dates back to the late 1950s. So I wanted to take on that that end of research, and the result was my second book, Eyewitness to Genocide.
I'd like to start by asking you to just kind of set up the broader context for this. What kind of efforts are made in the 40s and 50s to bring participants of the Holocaust to justice, and how effective were they?
Yeah, of course, most of your listeners will no doubt be familiar with the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. Mm-hmm. And everybody, wherever I travel, wherever I present papers, whether it's at academic conferences or just at university settings, you know, everybody has heard of Nuremberg. Relatively few people, especially outside our area of study, are familiar with the national trials that were conducted by the Germans of Nazi war criminals. And these trials are really, really interesting and produced a tremendous amount of material that is relevant not only to understanding human rights law and domestic German law, but for understanding the Holocaust and its progress. A lot of documentation was collected in connection with these trials, but they tend to languish in the shadow of the much more prominent and much better known Nuremberg war crimes trials. Now, right after the war, German courts were very limited in terms of the kinds of cases that they could try. Of course, the whole German legal system was more or less dismantled, at least held in abeyance for a period of time until really the fall of 1945 when it was reconstituted. There were various efforts to purge, insofar as it was possible at the time, to kind of purge or to cleanse the judiciary of its more notorious Nazi supporters. And then the German court system was reopened, but it was reopened with certain limitations on their jurisdiction. One of the things that German courts could not preside over in their cases were criminal trials involving the crimes of Nazi perpetrators on non-Germans, which effectively meant that for the first 5 or 6 years of the post-war era, German courts were at least technically forbidden to prosecute much of the criminality associated with the Holocaust, because these, you know, by very definition, by their very nature, the German crimes were committed on non-German nationals, on Poles, on Russians, right, on Balts. Mm-hmm. And so for this reason, you find relatively few true Holocaust cases between 1945 and 51. Most of the cases, and I've written about this just in journal articles and other works of scholarship that I've done, most of these cases related to a variety of offenses that had maybe connections with the Holocaust, but were not, you know, Holocaust specific. And I'm thinking of cases involving the first true mass killing that was made an object of German prosecution, which was not the Holocaust, but was the euthanasia program. And you see euthanasia crimes prosecuted already in late 1945 and 1946. And along with euthanasia crimes, the German courts were able, of course, to adjudicate crimes related to the Reichskristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass pogrom in November of 1938. Why was that? It was because these were crimes committed by Germans on other Germans. These crimes were justiciable under the terms of a Control Council law decreed in December of 1945, Allied Control Council Law Number 10, which said that Germans could not adjudicate cases involving non-German victims and German perpetrators, but if the perpetrator and the victim were German, then that was fair game for their jurisdiction. So, you know, almost by default, the Germans fall back on the November 1938 pogrom. They fall back on euthanasia. A lot of the cases that were adjudicated during this time focused on the so-called Infazeverbrechen. These are crimes that took place right at the end of the war, you know, as the noose was being tightened around the throat of Nazi Germany. Allies were advancing from all directions, and we see a spate of homicides carried out in connection with that, those final paroxysms of the Nazi state as it tottered toward its final collapse. A bunch of these crimes are put on trial then in the immediate post-war era, as well as crimes involving the so-called grudge informers. And I don't know how many of our listeners will be familiar with these crimes, but these involved, they're really extremely depressing cases, really. They involve some of the worst aspects of just mundane criminality, you know, turning your neighbor in to the Gestapo because they're listening to foreign radio broadcasts, and doing that because you covet your neighbor's apartment. They have a nicer apartment than you do, and you know that if they're turned in, they'll be arrested and sent off to a concentration camp or worse, and then you'd be in a position to receive their apartment. Hmm. Or maybe you have an interest in seeking the favor of the wife of your next door neighbor. And there actually are cases, you know, involving such motives, very, very base sorts of, you know, just reprehensible sorts of very common human vices involving self-seeking and self-dealing. So there's an entire spectrum of cases involving the so-called grudge informers, people to turn their neighbors in order to seek some kind of advantage for themselves. So these cases then were put on trial. But really not until the 1950s do you see efforts to put perpetrators of the Holocaust specifically on trial for their crimes. In terms of the quality of justice, as I write in my book on euthanasia, you see in the early post-war period, say from 1945 to 1947, 1948, pretty harsh punishments meted out, especially for murder. And of course, up until the time of the Grundgesetz, the basic basic law, the constitution of West Germany, up until that time, capital punishment was prescribed for any person convicted of first degree murder, and only in the presence of extenuating circumstances would the state exempt the person from capital punishment, instead give them a life term in jail. You know, that was only if there was an extenuating circumstance involved. You know, typically people were guillotined. That was the form of capital punishment at the time, up until 1949. And so you see lots of these Nazi perpetrators, particularly in connection with the euthanasia program, sentenced to death, convicted as perpetrators and sentenced to death and executed. And this continued for the 1945, 1947, 1948. Then we begin to see a change, and I write about this in my first book. There's a relenting in the severity of punishments that seems to coincide with the advent of the Cold War. And I was quite convinced when doing the research for my first book that there was an intimate causal linkage between those two events, you know, the outbreak of the Cold War and this new desire on the part of German society and, of course, of lawyers and of judges who are caught up by these cultural currents. There was a new desire to try to relent in punishment. So if you could somehow purchase time for yourself and delay your prosecution from 1945 or 46 until the late 40s, you had a much, much better chance of either not being convicted at all, maybe even not being indicted, or if you were put on trial, you at least could avoid the worst consequences, which is being convicted of murder and sent to the guillotine. So the quality of justice changes quite dramatically after 1948. And then by the 1950s, we see just a precipitous decline in the numbers of cases that are investigated and the numbers of people who are indicted as well as convicted for Nazi crimes. And that continues from about 1950, 1951 into the mid-1950s. And it gets to the point where it looks as though these cases are just going to be dissipate entirely. And of course, the 1950s, you're well aware of this, Kelly, as many of our listeners will be aware of this too. The Germans by the 1950s are involved in the Wirtschaftswunder. They're reconstructing their society. The economy is now beginning to take off, and there's a feeling that the past has been surmounted, very superficial feeling, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. it's there. That the Nuremberg and the burst of trials after 1945 had taken care of the perpetrators, and that a new West Germany, freshly minted, was coming into being in the 1950s. That was a belief that was exploded in 1955 and 1956, when a new investigation is set into motion involving a group of security policemen who operated on the German-Lithuanian border near Tilsit. The leader of this police unit was recognized by one of his erstwhile victims, who actually had survived the war. He was a rabbi in Stuttgart who just recognized this guy's picture fortuitously in the newspaper, and then reported him to the local police as being a person deeply involved in shooting Jews along the German-Lithuanian border. And this eventually turned into a major court case that came to trial in 1957. And it's sometimes referred to as the Ulm Einsatzgruppen case. And Ulm, of course, is the city where the trial took place, in Baden-Württemberg, the state of Baden-Württemberg in Germany. And for the most part in the literature, historians regard this as being a major turning point in a revival of interest in prosecuting Nazi criminality, and revealing to Germans from all walks of life that the perpetrators were still living in West Germany, and were living in some cases in quite comfortable circumstances. At least this is one of the dominant schools of interpretation among historians who study this. There are some historians who take issue with it. Annette Weinke, for example, believes that that there really wasn't such a pure engagement with or re-engagement with Nazi crimes, but instead this is an effort to try to fend off criticisms by the East Germans that West Germany was harboring Nazi war criminals. And so there's some split in opinion among the scholarship, but I think there is a near consensus that this trial taking place in 1957 really moved the West Germans toward a re-engagement with the crimes of the Nazis. And so thereafter we see the creation of a new organization that had never existed before in the city of Ludwigsburg, the Central Office for the Investigation of National Socialist Criminality, comes into being in 1958 as a clearinghouse for investigating Nazi crimes, and then forwarding the results of those investigations to prosecutors across West Germany, who then were free to issue indictments based upon the Central Office's findings. So this is the way in which the Germans kind of come back to a renewed engagement with Nazi crimes by the 1950s. And it represents a new kind of, a watershed in the country's history, and certainly a watershed in the history of prosecution of Nazi crimes that, as I mentioned at the beginning of our time together, mm-hmm. continues to the present day, most recently with the conviction of John Demjanjuk, and now reopening a lot of old cold cases, which are now warm again.
So you look at a particular set of these trials, the Operation Reinhardt trials. In just a minute or two, can you give a little background of what Operation Reinhardt was and what camps we're talking about?
Yeah, I certainly can. It's, again, I think for maybe some of your listeners, this will be quite familiar. Maybe for others, not as familiar. When we think of the Holocaust, it's helpful to think of that event as embracing independent programs, which targeted different groups of people and in different regions of Europe. Reinhardt came into being, insofar as we can tell, probably sometime in the fall of 1941, and it seems to have coincided with what many scholars, I'm thinking of Christopher Browning in particular, as well as the late Raoul Hilberg, believe was a verbal order by Hitler to set in motion the final solution to the Jewish problem, which was the extermination of all Jews within reach of the Germans in occupied Europe. Browning and Hilberg both believe that this order was probably given sometime in September, and I talk about this in the book. I think there's a lot of circumstantial evidence to support a September dating of this order. And we see a lot of activity flowing out of what is believed to be the order issued primarily by Hitler to Himmler and then conveyed down through the chain of command to Heydrich and others, Eichmann, to Mueller and the Gestapo. We know that there were meetings held in September between members of Section 2 of Hitler's personal chancellery. And this is the organization that, as we know, was in charge of the Nazi euthanasia program. There were meetings between Odilo Globocnik, who was a former Gauleiter of Vienna, and members of Section 2 of the chancellery. And it's believed that at this meeting, there was discussion of organizing a program that would be staffed by members of the Nazi euthanasia program as superintended or supervised by Section 2 of the chancellery, who would be detached from their assignments and reassigned to what was planned to be a series of camps in the Lublin district of Poland. It was not at the time called Operation Reinhardt. It was only given that name later on after, this is somewhat murky, but it's believed that after Reinhard Heydrich's assassination, the program to exterminate the Polish Jewry living in the Lublin district and really for much of the general government. Heydrich's name was attached to this program, perhaps as an honor to Heydrich. It's not really fully known whether Reinhard pertains to Reinhard Heydrich or not, but a lot of scholars believe that it was highly likely that his name was attached to it after his assassination by Czech partisans. But in the fall of 1941, we begin to see steps to organize the program. Eichmann wrote about this in his memoir from the 1950s and then later returned to it, of course, during his testimony in Jerusalem. He makes a trip in the fall of 1941, as he says, at a time when the leaves were at their height in Poland. This probably would have been sometime in October, fall of 1941. And Eichmann writes about encountering during his tour in the Lublin district, encountering Christian Wirt in a certain undisclosed location who was covered with dust and was involved in a construction project. And at that time, Wirt supposedly, according to Eichmann, showed him the beginnings of a facility which historians now believe was the Belzec camp. Belzec, in fact, becomes the first of the Operation Reinhardt camps. Two others follow thereafter, Treblinka and, of course, Sobibor. And Operation Reinhardt is identified with those primary camps. Now, some historians have referred to Majdanek as being perhaps a camp allied with Operation Reinhardt insofar as there were some interagency connections between these various camps. There were people who served in Sobibor or Treblinka or Belzec sometimes also were involved in Majdanek, and there were some jurisdictional interconnections as well. But I prefer to think of Reinhard Heydrich as comprising those three camps, as well as maybe some labor camps, I think Eponia Tawa in particular, that seem to have been connected with the project of the mass murder of Polish Jewry. But really, Sobibor, Belzec, and Treblinka are the focus of my book, and I think that they represent the black heart of Operation Reinhardt, which was frightfully effective in killing between 1.5 and 1.7 million Jews during their time. So this is Operation Reinhardt. Again, whether in fact it was named after Reinhard Heydrich or not is a matter of some dispute among historians, but my own belief is that it was in fact named after him.
So reading your book, one of the things that I really found enlightening was how difficult the process of identifying perpetrators and witnesses was. So can you talk a little bit about how the people in charge of the investigation tried to identify people to charge, people who were witnesses, people who might be able to identify or locate people who were charged? How does that all happen in the late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah, yeah, that's really one of the, what I'm hoping to be one of the more unique contributions of the book to Holocaust studies and German history, is trying to reconstruct how it is that that the investigators made their choices, made their decisions about whom they would focus on and whom they would overlook. I talk about this primarily in my first chapter of the book. It actually goes back to the construction of this new clearinghouse, the central office in Ludwigsburg, Germany. It, the central office had a certain mandate, and this came about through discussions between the attorney generals, who met every so often in conference to talk about what kind of jurisdiction the investigations would have. Who would they look at? Who would they charge or think about including within a charge, and who would they exempt? And the decision was made pretty early on in 1958 that the focus would be primarily on people involved in the Einsatzgruppen shootings, commanders from Einsatzgruppen units would be a focus, as well as the, you know, the lower rank and file who served within these Einsatzgruppen units, as well as death camp personnel serving primarily in Eastern Europe. There was a determination early on that the central office would confine its investigations to crimes committed in Eastern Europe, which, you know, obviously excludes then crimes committed on German soil. It would exclude crimes committed at Dachau or at Buchenwald or Flossenbürg or Mühlhausen or any one of a number of German concentration camps. Now, the focus would be primarily on crimes committed in the East. Now later on, the central office's jurisdiction would be expanded to include crimes that occurred elsewhere. But early on, the decision was to restrict the crimes considerably and focus exclusively on the crimes committed in Eastern Europe. What is especially interesting, I think, and I've had several other scholars who've read the manuscript comment on this to me, is the relative lack of knowledge about Operation Reinhardt and the kinds of people involved in Operation Reinhardt for many of these investigators working in the central office. And there was just a paucity of documentation early on available to them. And I talk about this in chapter one of my book. There was really just a handful of written sources. There were a couple of Polish sources that were drawn upon to try to generate names. There was this book written by Gerald Reitlinger, a very early book, called The Final Solution. It appeared in 1953. And Reitlinger, who based his information, much like Ernst Klee later will, on the trials of Nazi war criminals. And Reitlinger looked in particular at an early trial of some Silverbohr defendants, Erich Bauer being one, who was the Gasmeister, the gassing technician at Silverbohr. You know, a couple of other, actually three other people who were tried in 1951 by the West Germans. And most of these individuals were convicted. I think one of them was acquitted. Johann Clear was acquitted. The others were convicted. But of course, their trials generated documentation. And Reitlinger used these trials really as one of the major sources for his own work. That's an early history in 1953, The Final Solution. And that became then one of the primary documents that was used from secondary source documents. But then his primary sources were traced out by some of the investigators at the central office to try to identify the names of people who served at the Operation Reinhardt camps. Of course, in the late 50s, we also have a major event involving Adolf Eichmann and the discovery that he was living in South America, and his arrest and later his deportation to or abduction and his transportation to Jerusalem to stand trial. opened additional avenues of documentation. So there were lots of connections established between the West German investigators and Israeli authorities, working at Yad Vashem and also working within the Israeli police forces who were involved in generating material for the use of Israeli prosecutors like Gideon Hausner at the Eichmann trial. And so these become then avenues of research by the central office investigators, especially Dietrich Zeug. He was the point man for many of these cases, targeting Sobibor and Belzec and Treblinka. He was one of their major prosecutors. He was also assigned as an official observer by the West German government at the Eichmann trial in 1961. So these become some of the primary ways that that the investigators forged their connections with primary source documentation. And then, of course, once they had a list of potential defendants, or at least people who were suspected of involvement, they then had to determine where these people were. And toward that end, then they began canvassing all of West Germany, seeking to establish connections even with the East Germans. Those were problematic, as you probably know from reading my book. There was the so-called Holstein Doctrine, right, that really paralyzed connections between the West Germans and the East Germans, and really with the Eastern Bloc as a whole. But nonetheless, you know, through various loopholes, there were some efforts made to establish connections with the Czechs and with the East Germans, and even with the Poles. Not until 1965, I believe, was there an effort, though, to go to Poland and to actually, access a lot of this documentation firsthand by the West German police, by investigators. So it took several years for them to really overcome some of the geopolitics and lay their hands upon a lot of incriminating material that only became available a little bit later. But this is a process that that occurred very gradually, and you can hopefully in my book I try to lay it in a very systematic manner, just lay the cards on the table, and I step by step, how is it that the West Germans begin to assemble cases against these offenders, many of whom were able to reconstruct very conventional lives for themselves after the war. Some of them did it by adopting aliases, adopting pseudonyms, getting intriguing to have themselves declared deceased, the original person declared deceased as of a certain date in 1945, and then they adopt a different name, and they're able to reconstruct lives for themselves in West Germany or even in other parts of the world. Even Franz Stangl was able to, as we know, lived in Syria for a while, and then eventually immigrated to South America and lived there until in the mid-1960s, and eventually he's extradited. But a lot of these guys were living quiet lives as in some cases, respected citizens in West Germany and elsewhere. So now, by the 1950s, the West German authorities are beginning to try to track these people down. And their collaboration with the Israelis is critical. When you think of the numbers of witnesses in particular, survivors of the Holocaust who were living in Israel, the Israelis were indispensable to obtaining witness statements from survivors of the death camps. And there were survivors, it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. Only one survivor of Belzec, Rudolf Rader, was living in Toronto, Canada at the time. But you have far more survivors of Treblinka and Sobibor, not because those were more merciful places. They weren't. They were every bit as lethal as Belzec. But what you have with Treblinka and Sobibor are successful prisoner outbreaks. There actually are revolts by prisoners in which some prisoners managed to escape and even to survive until after the war, and again, in many cases, immigrate to other countries, including Israel. So Israel becomes a very important partner with the West Germans. And of course, the West Germans were really important partners also for the Israelis, particularly in connection with the Eichmann prosecution. Lots of reciprocal exchange of information and of witnesses shuttling back and forth between the Israelis and between the West Germans. And what I thought was interesting, as a scholar kind of looking into this, I saw just a real competent, professional, and committed attitude on the part of the West Germans to constructing these cases. You know, you might think that the West Germans might have had an incentive to be a little half-hearted, right, in the investigations mm-hmm. of their own mm-hmm. countrymen involved in these terrible crimes. But I just did not see evidence for that. What I saw was a real commitment to building credible, convincing cases against deeply compromised individuals.
I was struck when in reading your book about that this is a really problematic kind of case to prosecute, with witnesses that have been living elsewhere for by now 17, 16 years or more, with memories that have been impacted by all of the discussions that have happened over the years about these events, by witnesses who were observers of the event in this kind of traumatic environment, which may well impact the way they remember events even a day later. How did the judges and the prosecutors try and wrestle with these issues in these prosecutions?
It's infinitely problematic, isn't it? I mean, as an historian, you and other listeners of the podcast know how problematic, from a historical standpoint, eyewitness testimony can be. Of course, anybody with even a passing conversance with criminal law and criminal prosecution know that eyewitness testimony can be very deeply flawed. And this gets to issues that surpass Holocaust studies. Mm-hmm. And we get into issues of psychology and human memory, human cognition. And it's pretty clear that the human mind does not operate like a videotape machine. You know, it doesn't just transcribe with perfect fidelity mm-hmm. what is going on. And instead, we have a residue of factual memories, but we oftentimes fill in the gaps with our own imagination or our own assumptions about how things must have been. And we do this in some cases, in many cases, unconsciously. And we do it in perfect good faith. I mean, talk to any traffic cop who's investigating an accident. You know, they'll tell you. And I've experienced this too when I was working as an attorney trying to reconstruct things that happened involving clients of mine. I mean, you'll have four different witnesses to an event, and each witness, in perfect good faith, you know, speaking from their point of view in perfect fidelity to truthfulness, they'll give you four different versions of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? So now let's transpose this to the Holocaust. You have witnesses now who are coming back into a German courtroom, and some of their testimonies are transcribed under depositions and brought into the courtroom, but many of them appear as live witnesses in these trials. And how many years is it after the fact? I mean, these camps were dismantled in 1943. The trials took place between 1963 and 1966. Mm. So this is, in some cases, 20 or more years after the events have taken place. Now, these are traumatic events, of course, that really inscribe themselves in many cases very forcefully in the memories of these people. And what's remarkable as you read through the witness statements is how much they got right.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, 22, 23 years after the fact, you still have, in many cases, an extraordinary degree of acuity and accuracy in the witness's ability to recall what happened. But of course, there were many instances in which witnesses, in perfect good faith, provided flawed testimony. Now, if you're a judge, you're sitting there, and let's imagine that you have a pre-existing urge to acquit a defendant, and you're listening to testimony, and the only thing that is connecting this defendant to the crime is the testimony of the eyewitness in front of you. If you have a pre-existing urge to acquit, would you not have seized upon inconsistencies or flaws in the texture and the substance of the eyewitness's testimony, and then use that as a reason to acquit the defendant? And I make the assumption in the book, and maybe it's a problematic assumption, I don't know, but I think it's true to my own experience, that a person harboring such prejudices would, in fact, seize upon these inconsistencies and use them as a way to acquit. And yet, as I read through the court records and the investigation records, I saw no evidence of this pre-existing urge. Because over and over again, especially in the Sobibor trial, and but also in the Treblinka trial as well, it's particularly prominent in the Sobibor case. Lots of witnesses, and really good ones, coming forward, but they're still human beings operating with human memories. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, good witnesses would contradict themselves, or they would misidentify a certain person. They would confuse one person with another and project the crimes of one individual onto another individual, and they would do it in perfect good faith, believing that they were remembering correctly. Well, the judges are listening to this testimony, and every so often, you know, they would acquit a defendant of one of the charges based upon flawed recollection. And in these cases, the prosecutors themselves would admit that there were some problems with the witnesses' testimony. And even the witnesses would come forward and say, you know, I think I might have screwed this up. You know, I believed that this person, you know, defendant X, whoever it is, committed the crime. But now, you know, on further reflection, I could have mistaken this person for somebody else. So you even have the witnesses coming forward and admitting that in some cases, in some limited cases, they made mistakes. But what I found to be so extraordinary was that the court, in many cases, was willing to overlook inconsistencies in order to affirm the essential truthfulness and the essential accuracy of the witnesses' accounts. And in this regard, Kelly, and you'll appreciate this as an historian, they acted more as historians and less like lawyers in this regard. I mean, we all know how flawed human memory is, but that doesn't mean that the event is totally untrue. It just means that you have to take into account when considering what happened that people do not recall the events with perfect fidelity to history. And you see the judges, particularly in the Sobibor trial, but also to a certain extent in the Treblinka trial, and I think bending over backwards in order to accommodate the shortcomings in witness testimony. Right? And still, in many cases, issuing convictions, even though the testimony isn't perfect. Now, if you're trying a case today to a jury, I've done this, you know, it's been a few years, mm-hmm. no longer practice law, but I did 35 to 40 cases during my time as a prosecutor, then as a criminal defense lawyer. You're working on a case, and you have witnesses who, to be honest with you, I was doing a case as a defense counsel. I saw a prosecution witness. I thought the person was telling the truth in my heart. Mm-hmm. And yet, my obligation was to represent my client. My client, had his neck in the noose. And, my duty was to try to expose inconsistencies in the witness's statement so as to be able to impeach the witness and to plant the idea in the jury's mind that this witness might not have told the full truth. Right? That's how you impeach a witness. You tease out inconsistencies, including inconsistencies that are relatively minor, that really don't bear upon what the court calls the gravamen of the case and the essential facts. But you might point out that at an earlier interrogation by the police, this person had said that my defendant was wearing a blue shirt. And that in subsequent interrogations, they come forward with information that it was a red shirt or something to this effect. And of course, the human memory is not perfectly preserved, the precise color of the shirt. Maybe it does, but maybe it doesn't. And as an attorney, you would try to highlight this in order to discredit the witness, right, to impeach the witness. But in these cases, the judges in many instances would overlook the infirmities, the natural infirmities of human memory to uphold the essential truthfulness of the witness's statements. I saw no urge to engage in any kind of like a pre-existing desire to acquit the defendants or to ameliorate their guilt. Quite to the contrary, what I saw was every effort to uphold the essential truthfulness of the witness's statements and the witness's testimony.
And so given that, one of the things that's really interesting about your book is the way in which you outline the way in which the outcomes of these trials are significantly different for each of these camps. And in fact, in Belzec in particular, I believe, many of the people are actually acquitted. What happens there?
Well, that gets to the issue of the kind of the title of my book, Eyewitness to Genocide. I gave it that title for a very distinct reason. I wanted to emphasize how crucial eyewitness testimony was in the trials of Nazi war criminals, particularly in these cases. Mere presence, this is important, I think, to keep in mind when we approach this topic. It's hard for a lot of people, I think, to understand today. Mere presence in the death camp as a guard was not enough by itself to convict someone. Right? Under German law, you also had to show that that person committed a criminal act during their service as a death camp guard. Now, this law is changing. For anybody who's familiar with the Demjanjuk case knows, the Germans recently have come up with an alternative theory of criminality in death camps. Mere presence now in the death camp can actually shift the burden of proof so that now it's the defendant who has to show that he did not do anything in the camp.
Right? Can I break it just real quick? Because this is one of the if somebody had told me before I read your book that I would have asked this question, I would have looked at them like they were an idiot. But now, having read it, it seems a relevant and important question to ask. What are these people charged with?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of your audience will no doubt know that many of these people could not be charged with genocide because genocide was not a justiciable offense under German law in the 1940s. It's only after the passage of the Grundgesetz of the Basic Law in 1949 is genocide articulated as an offense under German law. And there was a belief that that you could only prosecute these people based on things they did in violation of the German Penal Code. So all of these individuals were charged with murder under paragraph 211, or alternatively with aiding and abetting murder, Beihilfe zum Mord, is the German phrase, aiding and abetting murder, essentially complicity to murder. So they faced their accusers based upon accusations of violating German law. They were never charged under German law with committing genocide. That was considered retroactive, right? Because the Genocide Convention is not passed until 1948, and under German law, genocide was not an offense until 1949. And the Germans are very much within that European tradition of shying away from retroactive applications of law and charging the Operation Reinhard death camps with genocide would have been considered retroactive.
And if I read your book right, the difference between being charged with murder and being an accomplice is actually a really significant distinction, right?
That's big, really, really big, for a lot of different reasons. The primary one, of course, is the range of punishment that can be meted out. Now, theoretically, I try to emphasize this actually in the footnotes of my book. I talk about this. Theoretically, you can, or you could, up until the 1960s, you could send somebody to jail for life for complicity to murder. That was the law. But oftentimes there's a gap between practice and theory, and the practice was that if you were found guilty as an accomplice rather than as a perpetrator to murder, you would be given maybe 3, 4, 5 years jail versus an automatic life sentence. So it was quite significant.
And what distinguished the people who are charged with murder and the people who are charged with being accomplices? As I read your book, there are a number of people who committed actions that we might reasonably call murder who aren't actually charged that way.
Yeah, it's so much of this is so counterintuitive, especially for those of us who come out of an Anglo-American tradition of law. And I think this has led over time to accusations by various scholars that the Germans were that the German judges were doing everything in their power to mitigate the severity of punishment that could be meted out to these Nazi offenders. But I don't necessarily see it from that perspective. I mean, this kind of goes back to a fairly complex legal history. that began in 1940 in the so-called bathtub case. I talk about this in the book. It's a really, really famous case in German legal history where a woman gives birth to an illegitimate child, and she's covered with shame. Of course, at that time, this is considered a very shameful sort of act. She's not married. She has a child. And so she recruits her sister to drown the child in the bathtub on her behalf. And the sister kills the child and then is convicted of murder. The case goes all the way up to the German Supreme Court. And in 1940, the German Supreme Court issues a verdict, you know, reversing the woman's conviction and finding instead that she could not or should not be convicted of murder, but instead should have been convicted of aiding and abetting murder. Why? Why was she an accomplice rather than a perpetrator? Well, according to the court, she did not commit this act in order to advance her own interests. She did not identify with the act and support it for her own reasons. Instead, she was more or less a tool. She was an instrument of her sister. And her sister was the real murderer here, the real perpetrator. And the actual killer, the one who really killed the child by drowning the child in the bathtub, was an accomplice to the murder. Now, this gives rise in German law to so-called subjective theory, which emphasizes that before you can be convicted of being a perpetrator of murder, the judge has to be satisfied that you have inwardly identified with the killing, that it serves some specific interest that you have. Some subjective interest that you have. Mere killing, even if carried out with your own hands on this theory, is not alone enough to convict somebody of being a murderer, which, of course, is counterintuitive for those of us who are familiar with American law. I mean, if you carry out a killing, even if you are not doing it for your own benefit or for your own purposes, you are still a murderer, right? And probably a first-degree murderer. You commit a crime with your own hands. This was not so under a subjective theory. Now, I want to emphasize that subjective theory was not initially followed by in a lot of Nazi war crimes cases after 1945. There were plenty of individuals who went to the guillotine in the 1940s who were executed who would have really fallen into that category of somebody who did not subjectively identify with a homicide, but was simply carrying out, you know, the orders or carrying out programs that were given to them by their superiors. But as they describe in the book, what happens over time is that subjective theory eventually usurps objective theory, so that by the late 1950s and early 1960s, especially by 1961, there's a major court case that I talk about in the book that really cinches subjective theory and cements it as a foundation of criminal legal analysis in West Germany. So that if you're the prosecutor, in order to convict a death camp guard of murder, you have to show that person inwardly identified with the killing of Jews at one of these Operation Reinhardt death camps, or that they had somehow exceeded their orders. Right? They were given orders to kill, perhaps they killed, but if they were not proven to have acted over and above the orders given to them, then at the most you can convict them of being an accomplice. And at the worst, if you don't have eyewitness testimony in order to connect them with specific criminal acts in the camp, then they could just raise the defense that they were acting under duress. And if you don't have somebody capable of contradicting that defense, then the defense is considered unrefuted, and the individual then would be acquitted. And this happened actually in several cases, especially in the Belzec case, where you had only one surviving witness, Rudolf Rader, who returns to testify in Munich against eight defendants in the Belzec case. But of course, his perspective is very limited, just one guy, right? And by the way, the other survivor, there were two survivors at Belzec. The other survivor survived the war, but then was lynched in a pogrom that broke out in Poland after the war. I mean, imagine, you survive Belzec, 99.999% death rate.
Wow.
You know, he survives, but then is lynched when he returns to his hometown after the war. But So Rudolf Rader is the sole living survivor, and he is not able on his own in order to refute the defenses of seven of the eight defendants. Ultimately, only one person is convicted, and that's the adjutant, kind of the liaison between the commandant of Belzec and Globochnik back in Lublin, the Lublin headquarters, and he was the head of the Operation Reinhard camp. So this is the adjutant who was convicted, and he's not even convicted as a perpetrator. He's convicted as an accomplice. So I write in my book that Belzec was really a resounding failure. It marks the low point in the effectiveness of the West Germans. But it's not due, this failure of the Belzec case was not due to a pre-existing urge on the part of the judges to acquit Nazi defendants. I mean, you might think it did, you know, if you just look at it superficially. How could seven of these eight death camp guards just walk? No, it really came down to the structure of German law, German criminal law in particular at the time, and the availability of witnesses. And if you didn't have witnesses who were capable of connecting these death camp guards with specific atrocities and specific crimes within the camp, there was a better than not chance that person would be acquitted. Mere presence in the death camp was not enough.
Well, you do a great job following these cases, and I want to encourage our listeners to go out and read the book or buy the book and follow it, because it's really there. It's well-written stuff, and it's very interesting. And let me ask a couple of kind of implied questions or reactive questions. The first is, how does the German public respond to these trials and their verdicts?
Yeah, it's difficult to answer that question because the German public was really all over the map in terms of their attitudes towards trials. There's a longer history here that some of our listeners might be aware of. There was overwhelming support, insofar as we can tell, for the Nuremberg war crimes trials. And again, the polling data is a little uneven, but from what we can gather based on some polling that was done right after the war, about 80% of Germans supported prosecuting Hermann Göring and prosecuting the major war criminals at Nuremberg. But of course, you know, the trials, the major war criminals were convicted, a small handful were acquitted, most of them were convicted and then punished. And a lot of Germans thought that that would be it, that the major criminals had been dealt with. Of course, a lot of them had been killed or had committed suicide before the end of the war. And the rest were now in jail and or had been hanged by the Allies. And so there was an assumption on the part of many, many Germans in the 1940s that after the Nuremberg war crimes trials, that there would be no further trials or there'd be relatively few of them. But as we know, that was not the case. The Americans themselves began another series of trials, the so-called successor trials, the 12 trials of the next level down. They weren't the major war criminals who were decisive in making policy, but this is the next echelon down. These are still important people, but not at the summit of the Nazi state. And there were 12 of these trials involving hundreds of defendants. And what you see in the polling data is that fewer and fewer Germans now are supporting a continued engagement with war crimes trials. And the numbers actually flip, where 80% supported the initial Nuremberg war crimes trials. Several years later, it's 80% who opposed them. And this continues then, you know, through the late 1940s. And by the 1950s, there's a belief in West Germany, as I mentioned at the beginning of our podcast, that you know, that this history was over. There's a major clemency program, the so-called McCloy clemency, which releases almost all of the Nazi war criminals who had been convicted and imprisoned between 1945 and 1950. By 1952, 53, many of these people are now auf freier Fuß, right? They're released from jail. And this continues until the late 1950s. And so we see a flooding back then of numerous individuals who either had been convicted in some of these trials from the 1940s, or in some cases, individuals who maybe were never put on trial, but had gone through denazification proceedings, and now they begin to re-enter the civil service. I write about this in the final chapter of my book, where we see a re-entry by the late 1940s and early 1950s, especially by 1951, of deeply compromised judges who had managed to conceal their wartime activities and maybe got clean bills of health from denazification boards. And now they re-enter. In some cases, they even have a claim, a legal entitlement based on Article 131 of the Constitution. They have a legal entitlement to reintegration in the civil service. So we see a re-entry of very deeply compromised people into the judiciary and other branches of the government in the 1950s. So that by the late 1950s, we see the Ulm trial by 1957 and a re-engagement with the crimes of National Socialism. The East Germans, in the meantime, had geared up their Blood Judges campaign, accusing the West Germany of harboring judges who had been involved in just dealing out really grossly disproportionate sentences to people who were convicted on racial or political grounds during the war. And so they begin leveling their charges, and the West Germans are kind of reeling from all of these factors. The upshot of it, of course, is the creation of the Central Office in 1958. So there were mixed feelings within the population. There was a desire on the part of the older Germans, the Germans of World War II, you know, who had survived the war. There was a feeling maybe that we should let bygones be bygones. But keep in mind, Kelly, this is a really interesting point, I think, at least I hope. But the early 1960s, the mid-1960s, exactly when these Operation Reinhard trials are taking place, we're beginning to see a changing of the guard, right? Mm-hmm. We're on the verge of 1968, right? And I try to suggest in the conclusion to my book that what we're beginning to see now is the arrival of a younger generation of Germans who were not compromised by the Nazi government. And there's some generational changes which now cause friction within West Germany. What was interesting for me as I began to delve into this research is I began to see interconnections, believe it or not, of all things, with the Red Army faction, the Rote Armee Fraktion.
Yeah.
And Gudrun Insulin was very emphatic about this, as were some of, you know, the members of this Baader-Meinhof group by the late 1960s and early 1970s. They say that one of the motives that drove them was this belief that the whole West German government was shot through with unreconstructed Nazis. I'm not sure how much of that was just a convenient defense on the part of the Red Army faction, or whether they really believed that the government was so corrupt and full of Nazis that extreme measures had to be taken, right, to deal with it. But this becomes a real generational schism within West Germany by the 1960s, and culminates then in the events of 1968. So I think there were some generational differences in the perceptions of these trials. A very uneven reception and perception within West Germany.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've taken a lot of your time, Mike, and I thank you so much for that. We try and often end these podcasts with a couple standard questions. And so the first of those is, I wonder if you would recommend a book or two for people who you, perhaps a book that was meaningful for you, perhaps a book that would shed further light on the topics that you've written about in the book.
Certainly. This really depends upon how deeply people want to get into the research and the kind of the nitty gritty details of the trials and Nazi criminality and post-war efforts to wrestle with it. I think a book that's very accessible for both scholars and for educated lay people who are interested in the topic is one of my favorite all-time books on the subject, and this is Gita Sereny's Into That Darkness. It's a book that's been out now, 1974, I think, was the publication date. So it's been out for several decades now, and yet I still think it's just a marvelous book. This is a woman who went into prisons to talk with Nazi war criminals like Franz Stangl, who was the commandant of Sobibor and was also a commandant at Treblinka, eventually was able to escape Germany after the war, lived in Syria for a period of time, eventually found refuge in Brazil. And she conducts a series of interviews with him, but not just with him. She also talks with some of the people that that my book looks at, like Gustav Munzenbacher, for example. She actually interviews him after his release from jail and has some really fascinating and personal sorts of observations about Munzenbacher, who at the time was living with his family right after his release from jail. So this is a wonderful, wonderfully insightful book. What I like about Sereni is she tells a really good story, for one thing. She writes very, very gracefully. And there's a moral earnestness and ardor to her work that I, in particular, find very appealing, and that I think other people might find meaningful, too. So that's one book I would recommend. There's another book, too, which has been out a very, very long time. Again, this is a book that many non-experts in the field, I think, would still get a lot out of. And even for experts, it's a book that repays rereading. It's a book that I think was the earliest book that I ever read on the subject of Nazi crimes. I read it as a teenager when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I think it did kind of plant an early interest in this topic for me in my mind when I was probably 15 years old. This is Simon Wiesenthal's book called The Murderers Among Us, which talks about his efforts to track down Nazi war criminals after the war and so that they could be put on trial and the justice could be served. For those who are interested in primary source documents, I think the best or one of the best English language sources was written by Ernst Klee, and I think he co-authored this with a couple other people. Willy Dressen, I think, it was another of his co-authors. But it's called The Good Old Days. It was translated from the German, Die Schöne Zeiten. The Good Old Days is a collection of primary source documents about Nazi crimes that have been translated from German into English, along with introductions by the authors. This is a wonderful book to teach from, and I think you mentioned to me that you've used the book in connection mm-hmm. with some of the courses you've taught, and I have too. It's a really good teaching tool, but it's a very interesting book too, and you get a lot out of it. And then finally, for those who read German, I recommend the old classic that provided my entree into this topic, which is Ernst Klee's Euthanasie im NS-Staat, which was his original monograph on the topic of Nazi euthanasia. I talk quite a lot about the euthanasia program, of course, in Confronting the Good Death, but I talk about it too in Eyewitness to Genocide. It was a crucial precondition to the final solution and to the expanded Holocaust in 1941. You know, Klee takes this very, very seriously as being a prelude to the Holocaust. And I recommend that book, along with his Documente zur Euthanasie, Documents to Euthanasia. And unfortunately, insofar as I know, neither one of these books has been translated, but they're excellent sources on euthanasia and also in primary source documents related to it.
So I found striking in reading the book is the number of time after time, as you're reading the little capsule biographies you give of these people, you see some version of this person was a nurse at Hadamar or at one of the euthanasia centers, and then was after this program was wound down in Germany, was transferred to the Eastern Front and ended up working in the camps. And it's remarkable how often that happens.
Nearly every defendant, with just a small handful of exceptions. There were some just hardcore SS types who were assigned there, but nearly every defendant in these trials came out of T4 and were, of course, employed. But they continued to be T4 employees, albeit given a different duty assignment.
Not familiar. T4 is one of the labels for the euthanasia or the organization that carries out the euthanasia program.
That's right.
But let me go back. So the last question then is, and from talking to you, I know it could be a long list, but in brief, what are you working on now?
At the present time, I'm actually writing a textbook of all things. It's a kind of a general world history of war crimes. How's that for a modest topic? What I discovered as I began to write the book is that I could easily write 8 volumes. This is such a multifaceted topic. But I thought it might be helpful for students, both undergraduates and also for graduate students, to have just a primer, a fairly compact, maybe 110, 115,000 word primer on on the world history of war crimes. So I'm writing that currently. It's about 85% done. I'm going to try to wrap it up if I can. I'm under contract to deliver a manuscript by October. I might have to delay that. We'll have to see. You know how it is.
Good to know lawyers take contracts seriously.
They do. Fortunately, I'm working with Bloomsbury Academic Press in London, and they've been wonderful to work with. So we might be able to delay if need be. But they really said that they want the manuscript insofar as it's even humanly possible to deliver by October. So that's my current project in terms of writing. And I'm also working on a geographical mapping project at Boston College, which is really a multinational project involving numerous scholars from across the world, including geographers and political scientists, as well as historians. And we're going to try to map the many geographical locations of the Allied War Crimes Program after World War II. So this is something also that's engaging my attention today.
Well, they both sound like fascinating projects, and I look forward to seeing them. And I hope when they're out in whatever form they take, that you'll be willing to come back on the show and talk about them.
It'd be a pleasure.
But I wanted to say thank you so much for your time and wish you the best of summers.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Bryant, author of the book Eyewitness to Genocide, the Operation Reinhardt Death Camp Trials, 1955 to 1966. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time for an interview with Samuel Totten. I'll talk with Sam about the situation in the Nuba Mountains in the Sudan, using both his book Genocide by Attrition and more recent articles and experiences as the basis for our interview. Until then, thanks for the download, and have a great month.